Okay, anyway, I apologize for last week. I was at a chasana, and my wife and I have been in Eretz Yisrael for 6 years. And throughout that time, we have a son in Baltimore who was never able to visit us, but his best friend got married last week, so my son actually came in. So we weren't good enough to bring him, but Baruch Hashem, so he came Friday and left on Monday, but Sunday night we were at the chasana of his best friend. So
he was just here for the weekend?
He was just here for the weekend.
That's a dedicated friend.
Yeah. Well, he has two daughters that that he had to come back to. But I find, you know, although I go to a lot of chasanas in the yeshiva, but I never stay. This was the wedding I stayed, and it was like the first time I danced in like quite a long time. So I'm still sore after a week. So I say I have to dance more at chasanas or something like that. But anyway, we are talking about Jewish weddings. And it's really a hakdama. It is a hakdama, unfortunately, to the Jewish divorce. So that's because halachically, the Jewish divorce is a more complicated process. And that is the crisis that is known as a crisis, known as the aguna crisis. The word aguna literally means anchored woman. And that refers to the predicament of a woman whose husband refuses to give her a get. And if a woman does not get a get, even if she has a civil divorce, of course in the state of Israel there is no such thing as a civil divorce, but even in America or other countries where there is a civil divorce, a woman is still a married woman until she gets a get. And the get process initially is in the control of the husband, and therefore there's a lot of potential. But before I get into what halacha allows us to do about this problem and how we can, I'm not going to say solve it, but how we can mitigate it and ameliorate it in various ways, I want to finish up a little bit about the marriage ceremony itself. And again, it is very important for all of you people who are either married or going to be married, Bezrat Hashem, Bekarov, that, you know, it's common sense to differentiate between a wedding and a marriage. They are not the same thing. A wedding is a one-night ceremony that has maybe six more days of rejoicing. So it's very, very nice. But a marriage is what you do with your life. And if you have to have a choice, what is more important, the wedding or the marriage? Obviously, it is the marriage. It is the marriage that is called kiddushin, sanctification, holiness, and the like. And the truth of the matter is, it is a common problem among men and women that we spend much more time planning a wedding than we do thinking about a marriage and thinking about a bias. What is a home? What are the values of the home? We know, again, I'm not going to, I know you probably have many, many classes that talk about this. I'm not going to over elaborate that much, but suffice it to, let me just mention two Ma'amarei Chazal that you probably know, but it's good to remember them. They should be mission statements in your life. One Ma'amar Chazal is Ish V'Isha Shechina Shiruya Beinehem. A man and a woman, when they live with shalom, the divine presence is with them. Hashem is with them. They become the Beis HaMikdash. They become the temple, the Mishkan, the dwelling place for God's presence on earth. That is how important the shalom bias is. It is the thing that brings HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence into the home. This is a famous Gemara. If you take the word for man, that's ish. And you take the word for woman is isha. They share two common letters, right? I'm sure you've heard this. Aleph and shin means fire. The man has a yud. The woman has a hey. Yud and hey are God's name. So when God is in their life, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in their life, the man is doing what a man does. The woman is doing what a woman does. If you take Hashem out of their union, they become a selfish, all-consuming fire in which each one burns up and destroys the other one with selfishness and anger. You understand the idea? Take out the yud and the hay, you have ish. Put in the yud and the hay, you have ish and isha. Right, so that's chazal number one. Chazal number two, I think women will especially like because it's addressed to the husband. And it says that what is a husband's responsibility in a marriage towards his wife? So Chazal say, it's a halacha. Ohava kegufo. He must love his wife as much as he loves his own body. Umechabda yoser migufa. And he must honor his wife more than he honors himself. Okay, this is a Maimer Chazal. This is a Gemara. And as a result, as the Rebbe often says, if it's in the Gemara, it's kind of a binding halacha. It's not just being a tzaddik or going beyond the basic halacha. This is the basic halacha. Ohava kegufa umechabda yoser migufa. So these are two Maamari Chazal. So when people talk about Judaism as being anti-women, etc., you have to, of course, we don't say that equality is sameness. Of course, there are things that men do that women don't do, and there are things that women do, like having kids, that men don't do. Meaning, we live in a world where people are different. And the fact that people are different is not a connotation of inferiority in any way. Right? Separate can be equal. And indeed, people have pointed out that when women want to do everything that men do, in a way that's a demeaning, that's a denigration of the uniqueness of a woman's identity, to say that her value is in doing what men do. So of course there are differences, but the differences should not obscure what the Torah says is the relationship of men and women, and how that has to be done with honor and with respect. And Ohava kegufo umechabda yoser migufa. Right. So these are halachos that one has to keep in mind. Now we did talk about, I think, the economics of what happens when a marriage is terminated, and just to go over it very, very quickly, the economic arrangements. First of all, let me point out that the way halacha works in money matters is all halachic rules can be changed by agreements. Meaning, I'm going to give you what are called the halachic default rules. In other words, what are the rules when there's no agreement? But halacha, not in everything. I mean, you can't make an agreement to work on Shabbos or to eat non-kosher food. Some things you cannot agree upon. But when it comes to money and property, the halachic system itself recognizes that people can reorder their property rights in any way they want. So any monetary rule in halacha, with one exception, the rules against interest. You can't charge interest even if both parties agree. But generally speaking, monetary rules are a branch of halacha that we call a default rule. You understand what a default rule is? A default rule simply means the rule that is applied when the parties have not come to a heskem, they have not come to an agreement. But halacha legitimates agreements. So I'm going to discuss briefly what are the default rules in halacha. So here we have to differentiate between a woman that is divorced and a woman that is widowed, because halacha does differentiate them. If a woman is divorced, basically she is entitled to collect a kesuva. And what is the amount of the kesuva? So the kesuva is expressed in terms of ancient currency, so you have to update it and figure out what it is. If she was a virgin at the time of her marriage, her ketubah is 200 zuz, and I'll discuss what that is, but the zuz is, remember from Chag Gadol, right? You buy a goat, you could buy how many goats? You could buy 100 goats, right? Because the goat in Chag Gadol... No, two zuz.
Yeah.
That's right. So 200 zuz could buy 100 goats. Right? If you follow the Chag Gadol conversion, right? In the Chag Gadol, my father bought a goat for two zuz.
How does that make women equal to men if you're putting a value on women?
No, we're not putting a value on women. We're talking about a settlement. We're talking about a divorce settlement. We're not saying a woman is worth 200 zuz.
Oh, like after a divorce? Like,
yeah.
I guess the society wasn't that equal because, like, women didn't really, I guess, have jobs.
Well, that's the reality, meaning to say the following. You know, you can't blame Judaism for a de facto situation. It indeed was the case that women were often vulnerable. They were often unprotected. This was the whole world was that way. The economic opportunities were limited. Now, the theory of a ketubah, now the problem is there was no cost of living adjustment. And I'll talk about how Halacha dealt with it. The theory of the ketubah was that 200 zuz was equivalent to support for 1 year. That is, the Rishonim say that that is what a ketubah was. A ketubah represented that what you owe a divorced woman is to give her support for 1 year, which in Talmudic times, 200 zuz, a zuz is an ancient coin, was able to supply. Now I'll talk about what a zuz is today, and the problem is that you'll see in a moment that today the value of 200 zuz is not really sufficient for that. And that does raise a halachic problem. Now, it's not an
issue. The areas in where she's living is in, it's like a year of support in their current home, because we said how she technically is allowed to stay.
Well, not a divorced woman. Again, that's only a widow.
Oh,
yeah, divorced woman has to find her own home. She now, so let me just go over the steps first, and then we'll talk about how this works. So let me first say what it says in the ketubah, then we'll try to translate it. So a divorced woman is entitled to 200 zuz as a base kesuvah, and then it is customary that the chatan agrees to an additional amount, and that is called, technically it's discretionary, but it's become standard custom. And the discretionary amount is also expressed, not in terms of an ancient currency, but in terms of a medieval currency, called 100 zekukim, which is like German marks from the Middle Ages. Again, so we have two numbers, neither of which automatically computes into anything modern. The ketubah of a virgin bride is 200 zuz, is called mandatory ketubah, and 100 zakuk or zakukin is the tosefet, the additional amount of the ketubah. Now, what do these amounts compute to? So the truth of the matter is, currency conversion is actually a much more complicated halachic idea than you would think. But the way it's normally done is by the amount of weight of silver in the coin, and then you translate it into the amount of silver. Meaning to say, a zuz was a coin in Roman times, okay, but it had a certain weight of silver. X number of ounces of silver. So you look at 200 zuz as a certain number of ounces of silver, and basically, depending on the price of silver, the 200 zuz is usually between $5,000 and $7,000. So a base ketubah is not that much. The base ketubah is only around, let's use the higher amount, $7,000. And the tosefet, based on the German mark, is another $12,000. Again, it varies with silver weights. So a ketubah, if you add up the mandatory ketubah and the discretionary tosefet ketubah, is under $20,000. Now the problem is that in Talmudic times, even the base ketubah, which is only $5,000, was supposed to carry somebody for a year. Today, it really doesn't carry you for a year, even if you have everything there at all. So the question becomes, how do we respond to that particular problem? So the Rabbanut in Israel actually encourages ketubot to have the equivalent of what you might call in modern language a cost of living adjustment, meaning to say they will put in extra amounts to indeed give a woman that 1 year of support. Other people are more traditional, and they simply say, hey, the ketubah is a document that goes back thousands of years. We don't simply tamper with it and the like. And you'll see differences in Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Ashkenazim, in this matter at least, tend to be more traditional, and they stick with these picayune amounts, these small amounts. Sephardim tend to have more tailor-made negotiated ketubah, which might say a million shkalim. I think the Rabbanut doesn't allow a ketubah for more than a million. A million is their maximum, but you know, you can have a ketubah a million shekel. Actually, a million shekel is not—it's not a phenomenal amount of money, really. If somebody—I mean, a million shekel is
for a year.
Well, yeah, but that's all the woman gets. It's a settlement of $250,000, basically, right? A million shekel. Again, you know, it's okay. But if you think about these, now again, though, let me remind you that the ketubah is a mandatory document. But if the parties enter into their own either prenuptial or postnuptial agreement, they could put in whatever amounts of money they want. And commonly, in a wealthy family, they will negotiate with lawyers to have an agreement. And that's not anti-halacha. I want to emphasize, that type of agreement is not against halacha, because halacha permits the parties to negotiate. Let me also point out a very important thing. That when marital property is in the names of husband and wife, let's say they have an apartment or a home, then halacha certainly says the woman gets 50% of the home, because she's a co-owner. In other words, the ketubah rules apply if everything is in the husband's name, so this is what the husband gives her. But if indeed she's a co-owner, she 1,000% will get 50% of the property. So one needs to modify it. But the point I want to make is that a divorced woman gets no protection other than the ketubah, number one. Number two, whatever agreement existed between the parties. And number three, her 50% interest in property that is registered in both their names. Other than that, according to halacha, she does not get alimony. She does not have the right to stay in the family home, unless she's a co-owner, in which case, you know, etc. Now, this is different than a widow. A widow is a very, very different situation. A widow is treated differently in halacha than a divorcee. A widow does get the ksuva, the same ksuva. But the difference is, the widow is entitled, in addition, to live in the family home, rent-free.
Who gives her the money?
The money is collectible out of the estate of the husband who either dies or divorces her.
Oh, she doesn't just get it all?
What do you mean?
Doesn't she get all of his estate?
Absolutely not. She actually gets none of his estate. According to halacha, you're talking about a widow?
Widow, yeah.
No. Okay, this is an important point to make. According to halacha, when a man dies, unless there's a will. See, things can be changed. When a man dies, his property does not go to his wife. His property goes to his children. However, it's very different than secular law. Mm-hmm. However, when it goes to his children, the children, number one, have an obligation to pay the ketubah from the assets that they inherited. Number two, the family home, although it is theirs, but she is entitled to stay in that home rent and mortgage free, and that means they have to pay the utilities and the maintenance until she remarries, after which she could be ordered to vacate the home, or until she collects her ketubahs, which means for a widow it makes no sense to collect the ketubah until she remarries, because if she would collect the ksuvah, she would no longer have the right to the family home. So a widow stays in the home and is entitled to be supported, food, maintenance. Now,
does that actually happen?
It does happen. I mean, most of the time, listen, if the widow is the mother of the kids, hopefully they'll take care of their mother in a decent way. I mean, right. You shouldn't have to go to Beit Din and you know, yeah. force these things. But sometimes feelings are bad, especially if, let's say, the widow is not the mother of the children. The widow might be a second wife. She might be a stepmother of the children. Mm-hmm. And especially if she married the husband late in life, the children might be resentful. Some of you might know these dynamics, that they might feel that, hey, the second wife is eating up the money that would have gone to us, or whatever it is. So sometimes in a Beit Din there will be issues where the widow will sue the stepchildren,
right.
Etc. And these could be very messy, and you know, hopefully it shouldn't happen that often, but it does happen. Okay, but I just want you to understand this, meaning the property actually goes to the children, but the children must let her live in the family home rent-free, mortgage-free. They pay utilities, they pay mortgage. She does not pay rent. They are also obligated out of the assets of the father to give her the food and the clothing.
What if they're like little children?
Yeah, so the way it works is this. So the way it works is that in a religious court system, it'll happen in Israel, they will appoint what is called an aputrapis. That's a word from the Gemara. Aputrapis is just a Greek word, really, but it's in the Talmud. It means a guardian. And the guardian, or an executor, the guardian manages the property on behalf of the kids, but he will also fulfill the obligations towards the widow. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct.
So the now, the
widow herself could actually be the apotropist. That's 100% correct. The widow now, there's a little bit of a conflict of interest because she might use too much money for her expenses. So a Beit Din might look into that a little bit. But strictly speaking, the wife herself can be the apitrapis. If she's the natural mother, it's almost inevitable she'll be. Even if she's a stepmother, at least if there's been an adoption or something, she will probably be as well. But technically, I want to point out, she does not own the property. The property belongs to her little kids, but she manages the property for them, and she lives in the home until...
Assuming there wasn't a secular will.
That's correct. Now, if there was a will, again, everything here is interlocking, so we have to give another talk on that. But halacha would often recognize the secular will, in which case she will then become the heir. But in the absence of a will, it's very... Again, I know this may be difficult to you, because there is a little bit of an asymmetry. If a woman dies... her husband does inherit 100% of her property. If a man dies... Well, she could do a will too, though. She could do a will. Yeah. But if a man dies, a wife does not inherit, but as they say, she does have the right to family home, and she has the right to be supported. And indeed, the Talmud points out, if there's not enough in the estate for the kids and the widow's support, the widow's support has priority, even if the kids have to go out begging for their own bread. So the widow is actually maybe better off, because she's not an heir, but she is a creditor. In other words, they owe her that money, and that is the number one obligation that has to be paid off. So you could debate, is the woman necessarily at a tremendous disadvantage? Okay, so that is why a widow in the halakhic system...
Like a dangerous setup that the husband automatically gets the lands.
The guy could have killed her.
Right, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, so let me tell you some very
poison her very slowly.
Well, okay.
Let me tell you
some interesting historical rules. What I just told you is the law of the Gemara and the law of the Shulchan Aruch. But what's interesting is that there were local communities with very great rabbis like Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, very great rabbis, but they didn't change the halacha overall. They made special enactments for their cities, which became precedents. And the special... In other words, it didn't become permanent halacha, but it became these are called takanos of individual kihilot. It's a whole area of halacha that people often don't explore, the notion that there were individual kihilot that made takanos, and some of these takanos created what you might call a sliding scale, meaning to say they would provide if a woman died within 1 year of marriage, 100% of her assets would go back to her parents. After 2 years, 50%. In other words, they made a gradual... Right. Instead of saying, you know...
You live with her for 20 years, you get it.
Yeah. And instead of saying, you know, you married her Monday and you kill her on Tuesday and you get all of her property, right. You know, they had all sorts of graduated... So in a way, it partially addresses. Now, that did not become mainstream halacha, so to speak. But this was a takana that was applied in many, many kehilos. This is called, in fact, you can really impress Rabbi over lunch. He's saying, this is called takanas shum. Now, this is a bit funny, because shum...
Garlic?
Well, shum means garlic. That's 100% correct. So takanas shum sounds like the takana, which is also a takana, to eat garlic on Shabbos. That actually is a takana. But this doesn't refer to that. Shum is an abbreviation for Spira, Varmazia, and Magenza. These are three German cities. Spire, Worms, Spire, Worms, and Magenza. Mayence. So these are three big German cities. Shum, right? Shum. Spira, which is Spire. Varmazia, Vav, which is Worms. Worms. And Magenza is the Hebrew form for Mayence. Am I pronouncing it correctly? And these were three...
Mints?
How do you pronounce it? I mean, it's spelled M-A-Y-E-N-C-E. That's how it's spelled. Yeah. These are famous Jewish, old Jewish communities in Germany. They're still around. Worms was, in fact, Rashi's community. Rashi went from Germany to France, but Rashi initially was in Worms. So the Takana Shum, this was a Takana that they made in those three cities to have a graduated scale. But as I say, it didn't become mainstream halacha, so to speak. But it's interesting. People talk about how come they made takanas in those days and not today. I mean, that was post-Talmudic. That wasn't from the Gemara. That was, you know, a whole... In fact, in some places they even made a takana that daughters would inherit equally with sons. They actually made takanas.
But that also happened in the Torah. There was an incident that daughters...
No, but that was different. See, in the Torah said daughters inherit if there are no sons. Okay, in other words, that's what the Torah says. That's what the daughters of Tzolofchad established by saying our father had no sons. But in some of these cities, they made a takana that even if there are sons, daughters would inherit equally. Okay, those are problematic. These are rabbis who did this. How could rabbis make takanas like this?
Well, how could they? And why don't they anymore?
Well, it's a lot of discussion. The problem here is, or the issue here is, you may have come across these principles in Gemara, that when it comes to money and property, a Beit Din has the power to declare property ownerless and give it to somebody else. These are special powers of property, hefker based in hefker, it is called. And that is the basis of these takanas, but the question is, which Beit Din is great enough to exercise those authorities? And there is kind of a sense that we are not great enough to do those types of things. Again, these are, you know, issues. Okay, but be it as it may, this is the difference between a widow and a divorcee. A widow does have the right to live in the family home and be supported until she remarries. A divorce, and then she gets her ksuva. A divorcee only gets the ksuva and property in which she is a partial owner, but she does not have alimony or the right to live in the family home. So a divorcee would like to get her ksuva as soon as possible. A widow would like to get her ksuva as late as possible, because until she gets her ksuva, she has the right to live in the family home. There's also a lot of discussion about wedding gifts. You know, wedding gifts can sometimes be quite a lot. Let's say people get divorced. How do you divide wedding gifts? And generally speaking, we treat wedding gifts as a 50-50 proposition. They are split equally. What about the gifts that the chassan gives the kala, such as the wedding ring? All right, it's an issue. If we get divorced, you know, do I get the wedding ring back? You know, after all, I spent $1,000. Right. So generally speaking, I'm cheap anyway. So the thing is that the basic idea is that a wedding gift is a gift that the chassan gave to the kala. It's a gift, and after all, we did get married, even if it was for a week. So generally speaking, the kala is permitted to keep the wedding ring, but they say alpi kabbalah, it's not a good thing. In other words, when a marriage, God forbid, has gotten dissolved, you know, get rid of anything connected to that marriage. It's good to have a fresh start. So mystically, It's not so good to hold.
So she should just
sell it, okay. Yeah, but mystically, don't hold on to that stuff.
So
but,
if you sell it, and you invest the money, does that count as...
So that's the question. Does the taint, does the bad vibes follow the money and the object? I know that some Kabbalim don't want a woman to hold on to anything.
Get it remodeled.
Okay, you can do that. You can do that.
Not diamonds,
but the ring. You redesign the ring.
You redesign.
You redesign the ring. Okay, okay. So now,
she's got the important ones. Ain't gonna do it.
Now let me mention too about child support. As I mentioned, the Talmud is a very strange rule when you first hear it, and that is the obligation of a father to support a child. Let's say there's a divorce or even a death. What does the child get from the estate? According to the Talmud, is only until the age of 6. Now that sounds mighty, mighty bizarre. But the Talmud seems to maintain that once a child was 6, in those days in particular, they were capable of fending for themselves. They could beg, they could work. Child labor did and does exist throughout the world even today. But there's a very, very important psak of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein said that the age of child support is a function of the customs of the country of when are children independent and capable of working. In a society where little children worked, that could terminate the duty of support. But in a society where kids don't really work independently till they're 18, so that becomes what is called the minhag, that becomes the custom, and everyone who gets married is assuming the customary levels of support. So Rabbi Feinstein actually ruled that child support exists at a 100% level until a child is 18 years old, which makes the halacha, according to Rav Moshe, the same as the secular law. The secular law is exactly the same thing. And that works out very well. But I will tell you that there are Hasidic Beistins, which tend to be more conservative, so to speak, maybe less pro-women, however you want to describe it, that will sometimes let a man off the hook and tell the man, you don't have to support your kids after the age of 6. Although that's the Gemara itself, by the way, does say that such a man is considered to be cruel. And it's very interesting. Although the Talmud says, after 6, you don't have to support your kids. Meaning, a Beit Din is not going to force you to support your kids. But the Talmud says, such a man is cruel and immoral. So, the Talmud doesn't approve of this behavior. But it does say, after 6, we're not going to force you. Rabbi Feinstein said, we will force you till you're 18. Other Hasidic Beit Din will still go with the old rule.
Generally, the guy would be forced.
This is where things get very murky, because it depends which Beit Din is hearing the case. If it's a Beit Din that follows Rav Moshe Feinstein, they will force the person to pay until the child is 18. If it is a Beit Din that does not follow Rav Moshe Feinstein, then they will not force the person.
Can a woman choose the Beit Din, or only the man can?
So the truth of the matter is that the woman can actually choose the Beit Din. If the woman is seeking child support, I'm sorry. She has to bring the case where the husband lives.
So what if he chooses a Beit Din that won't support her? Whether he's called not cruel, she's left without any.
There's going to be an issue. There's going to be an issue, and this occasionally happens that women are again. You have to know the Beit Din. Now, as long as she goes to a Beit Din where the husband lives, she could choose the Beit Din in that city. Okay. Let's say Muncie, right? There are many, many Beit Dins and the like. Now, let me just mention one thing. There is, of course, both in America, really every country, and even in Israel, there is, of course, a whole secular law about child support and the like. And a woman can always say, hey, I'm going to go to secular court and get child support. And if the guy doesn't pay, he's a deadbeat dad, and he'll go to jail. But here
that's
is
why you can't take.
No, that's what others. Yeah, that, but here you have to remember the principle we talked about 2 weeks ago, that it is actually forbidden for one Jew to take another Jew to a secular court unless the other Jew refuses to go to a Beit Din.
But what if you're in a Jewish state and probably the judges in the secular court are also Jews?
Well, no, the fact that the secular judge is a Jew is not an advantage, it makes it worse. In other words, because it's not that the Torah says you got to go to a Jewish judge. We don't care if the judge is a Jew or a goy. Rather,
well,
you have to go. You have to go to a Beit Din that will apply the Jewish law. So just because
but if the Jewish law puts a woman and a children in disadvantage, and the guy is obviously abusing the system, then there should be some kind of logical explanation to why she should be prompted. Let me just say, as a general matter,
here is the principle, and this principle applies to men and women. If the halacha says that you only get this and you don't get that, but if I go to secular court, I'll get more, that's not a justification to go to secular court. The fact that I will do better, I could be a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. In other words, I understand the Yetzer Hara, and I understand the Yetzer Hara. In other words, it's obvious that a person normally thinks, oh, if I could do better by going to a secular court, I want to go to a secular court. But I just have to tell you, that's not enough of a reason.
Unless they're a bunch of crooks.
If a Beit Din is corrupt, if a Beit Din is dishonest, if a Beit Din takes bribes, well, even then, I would say find another Beit Din. I mean, that wouldn't automatically...
What if there is none?
Then you sue the Beit Din.
Okay.
Can you take a Beit Din to court with another Beit Din?
Well, as a matter of fact, you know, I was sued. I myself, this was something that happened. I was on a Beit Din 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. And I was the youngest man in the basement then. I used to be, you know, younger. And we decided against the husband. And the husband was one of these people who never accepts defeat. Anyway, you have to admire him. He's tenacious. And the head of the basement was a great Rosh Hashiva who died. He wasn't alive. And the middle member of the Beis Din was a very prominent rabbi who just ignored this guy. This guy was summoning us to a Beis Din, and he just threw it into the garbage. But I was naive enough to think, well, if someone is summoning me to a Beis Din, I ought to go. So he came all the way from Baltimore to Jerusalem to sue me in a Beis Din. In other words, he was suing me as a member of a Beis Din in front of a Beis Din by saying that we didn't follow the proper halachos and we didn't follow the proper procedure, and there was ex parte communication. That means that there had been, you know, he alleged that we had spoken to one party without the other party present, and he was suing me. Why I should be responsible for everything, I don't know. I was one of three people, but I was the only one who responded. So he was suing me. We had paskins. This was 20 years. I didn't even remember the case. I mean, we had paskins that he owed $12,000 to his wife. That was our psak. So 20 years later, he's suing me for $12,000. So I went in front of the Beis Din. The Beis Din is being sued in front of a Beis Din. But I can tell you, I knew ahead of time that it's almost impossible. A Beis Din almost never wants to look into what another Beis Din did. Because then, aim the dove herself. Because then I could sue this based on, you know, for, you know, whatever. You can keep on going on forever and ever and ever. And the case was dismissed. Although, you know, it went on for a while. But the case was dismissed. So when you ask me, can a based in sue a based in, the answer is yes. That's exactly what happened to me. I was actually somewhat interested because I wanted to see how those cases work. I had never seen that type of case before, so it was interesting for me to actually gamble. Yeah, right.
What was the reprimand for Beis Din? Had they found you guys guilty?
Well, had they found me guilty?
They can't find
me
guilty.
Yeah, well, no, they could in theory. I mean, if there would be evidence. No, if there was evidence.
Bring the Torah.
If there was evidence, I took a bribe or something. Yeah. There are bases. But they're not going to.
But not
They're not going to reverse it because they say halachically you made a mistake. You know, they'll accept the
right.
But yeah. Well, what could have been the worst that could have happened to me is they could have ordered me to pay $12,000, meaning the money that I made him pay, they could force me to reimburse. That almost never happens, but theoretically, that could actually happen.
Do you think the whole 20 years he didn't pay his wife the money?
I could imagine it. I mean, he's a person. Psychologically, it was very, very interesting. I mean, he's an extremely tenacious person, and his tenacity allowed him to accomplish many, many things. It also made him many, many enemies, because he's just a person that, you know, he doesn't stop till he gets his way. So he was able to build, you know, Erevs in city. You know, he's able to do a lot of things. But, you know, he's kind of like a bulldozer. I mean, imagine, 20 years, you know, he's been trying to... $12,000 or 20 years, I mean, you know, who fights over that? This is not $1 million, you know. This did not make him or break him. He got married his second time, and he had a second home. And he's litigating over something that happened 20 years before about his first divorce. I mean, who's doing that? Okay, whatever. I don't want to get into all of those details, but it was, as I say, it was. I don't know if it was fun, but it was, as I say, it was educational. Okay, now, but be it as it may, I do want to point out this obvious proposition: you can't go to secular court just because you're gonna get a better deal. That is not a legitimate reason for a man or a woman. If there is no Beis Din, or if a person will not go to a Beis Din, or if the Beis Dins are all corrupt and or dishonest, which can sometimes happen in some communities, that's one story. But if the Beis Din is honest, but it happens to be a woman or a man is not going to fare so well, how can I say? That's like saying, well, it's more convenient not to keep Judaism because I can get a better job if I work on Shabbos. I mean, it's the same type of avera. So it's a big HR. I understand that women are sorely tempted to go to the secular court for child support and the like, but it would not be permitted. Now, let me point out one thing, though. Let me point out that there are some things that a woman can do better in a Beis Din, monetarily, than in a secular court, and that is yeshiva tuition. This is very, very interesting. You know, if you in Israel it's cheaper, but in America, one of the major expenses that families have is yeshiva tuition for their kids. Right? I'm talking about day school, you know, elementary school tuition. Now, this could be a lot. This could be up to $10,000 per child. Now, they max out after 5 children. So if you have more than 5 children in the school, they'll give you a discount. But that still means that tuition can sometimes cost $50,000. And even with scholarships, which are somewhat generous, in fact, actually part of why tuition is so high is because so many people.
Kids in Australia.
Okay, that's good.
More,
that's good.
It's $25,000 for tuition education.
Now, obviously, a father should pay for the tuition of his children. That's Jewish education. In fact, the Alter Rebbe has a whole chapter in the Shulchan Aruch on the obligation of a father in particular to pay for the Jewish education of his child. But if dad is a deadbeat, dad basically says, hey, mom, you know, you have the kid, you take care of it. If the woman goes to secular court, a secular court is not going to add any money to the child support based on private school tuition. Because as far as a secular court is concerned, they'll tell mom, you can send your kid to public school. Why should we make your... If your husband doesn't want to pay for a private school, why should we make your husband pay for a private school? By contrast, if a woman goes to a Beit Din, a woman can get private school tuition because the Beit Din will say, as a religious matter, a father is obligated to pay for the religious education of the child. So that's a good example where a Beit Din can actually give a woman more. So it may be overall child support might be less, but the Jewish education component could actually be more. Another difference that there might be
is... What if they can't, like, afford it?
Well, if they can't afford it, obviously, no basin or no court can force a person to pay what they don't have, so they work out some type of compromise, and at that point, a day school will give a scholarship, meaning a day school will not give a scholarship to a single mother if her ex-husband has the ability to pay, even if he doesn't want to pay. A woman might find herself in a difficult situation, but if neither party has the money, so that's when scholarships kick in. You see? By the way, a big issue in Lakewood and other communities is do you make grandparents pay for tuition? This is actually a very, very big issue. Because a lot of...
How many people would even think, what's that going to do?
Oh yeah, you'd be very surprised, because what happens is, in Kollel communities, where the parents are living in Kollel, and they don't have that much money, and they have big families, so they don't have money to pay tuitions, but they're supported by their families, who might be business people and the like. So the schools, actually, many schools have tuition policies that say that if your grandparents, meaning the parents of the parents, have money, we're not going to give scholarships based on their income, which forces grandparents to pay that tuition.
But if they don't want to pay, they won't pay. And, it's still in the same situation. They're pickle, basically. Because they have kids.
I understand. But then the schools have a strangle. The schools basically, listen, we can't force the grandparents to pay, but we can say, we are not giving your children scholarships based on your grandparents' ability to pay, which means the kids won't be able to go to the school.
So it's not solving the situation.
So that's it's a blackmail on the grandparents. You want your kids to go to yeshiva here, you better cough up the money.
And the grandparents would say,
if they're not religious, maybe they'll say that. But if they're religious, they're not going to say
it. If they're religious, it might be just spiteful people.
It might be. That happens.
Depending on where the divorce happens.
See, you have to understand. I mean, this is not a talk on. This is not a talk on Jewish education generally, but I want to educate you a little bit about problems that exist in these are problems that exist in communities, and you have to understand that Baruch Hashem, the Torah observant communities have grown tremendously in recent years, high birth rate, etc., and a lot of them don't have money, and as I said before, the reason why a day school tuition is so high is because such a high percentage of the student body is on scholarship. Meaning, if everybody would pay a full tuition, the full tuition would be lower. Huh?
That drives me nuts when they do that. Like, why don't they just make tuition lower instead of charging some people a lot and giving that money back to other people?
Teachers need wages.
Part of the problem is that there are people, there are many people who need virtually full scholarships. And when you have more and more full scholarships, tuition on the other for the people who could go higher and higher and higher and higher and higher and higher, and then they start looking at grandparents, looking at other avenues of support.
Why don't they start educating people so they can actually support themselves?
Well, it is an issue. You know, in Eretz Yisrael, we are grappling with this right now, because in the Haredi community, for already many, many decades, people have been only educated to learn Torah, which is a wonderful thing, but no parnasa, no way of making a living. And that was okay when you had rich fathers-in-law. But now the problem is it's been so many generations.
Someone else who needs to pay. Like, why there is no not capturing a way to make sure that everyone's educated so they can provide for themselves.
So let's go back again, this is going a little off the topic, but okay, everything is connected. In the time of the Gemara, let's go back to the Gemara's time. The Gemara talks about a great rabbi who was the Kohen Gadol as well. His name was Yehoshua ben Gamla. And Yehoshua ben Gamla actually made a great innovation during the second Beis HaMikdash. And that is, originally there were no elementary schools. There were higher yeshivas, but how did children learn chumash and how to read, etc.? Everything was homeschooling, because the Torah says in Kriya Shema, "Vishinantam levanecha," you shall teach your children. Later, when they're more advanced, they would go to advanced schools, but the initial basic education was a home function. But Yehoshua ben Gamla saw that the homeschooling no longer worked. Some parents were not capable of teaching their children. Some children did not have parents who could teach them. There were many orphans in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple and the like. So he made a takana that every Jewish community must establish a public school, I mean a religious public school, that would be open to every child to learn Torah. And how were those schools supported? They were supported exactly like the public schools of secular public schools. Everybody in the community, even if you didn't have children, instead of saying the parents who use the school pay tuition, Yoshua ben Gamliel's takana was a recognition that to educate Jewish children in Torah is a benefit to everybody, even if I don't have children. But it's producing Jews that keep the mitzvahs. So his model was absolutely very different than our model. Our model is a tuition-based model, which, especially when you factor in scholarships, creates a crushing burden on many, many parents. His model was the entire community. Now, how would that work in Jerusalem, where you have, you know, a million schools, or New York? You know, it's not clear. But at least in a smaller community, let's take, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, right? So there is one day school. That would mean, now we don't have a way of forcing it today, but if you applied the halachic system, how are you going to force them? But every Jewish person, whether you have children or you don't have children, you would pay a certain amount of money to keep that school operating. Now, if you think about it that way, that would lower the financial burden tremendously, because you'd have so many more people who would be supporting a school instead of the 100 parents, you know, who send their kids there. And out of the 100, there's only really maybe 50 that are paying any significant money. So there actually is a model. It's so interesting that there are Jewish rabbis and philanthropists who are trying to encourage the notion of communal support. Now, it's very complicated today because, number one, we now have Orthodox conservative reform. So how do you do that? And number two, even within Orthodox, we have so many different types of schools. So it's one thing to tell me I have to pay something for the day school in Hartford, Connecticut. It's another thing to tell me I have to pay for 500, you know, day schools in New York City. How are you going to cheshbon it? So there are complications, but you understand the concept. And again, this is not an innovation. This is going back to the takana of Yehoshua ben Gamla. Yeah.
Okay. So I work at a school. It's a very, very wealthy school, but they do not give scholarships at all to anyone.
Ah, okay.
So technically, and there's not a lot of schools in Sydney, technically, if I was a parent and I wanted to send my child to a Jewish day school but could not afford it, if I went to the Beit Din and said, these schools aren't letting my child in because they're not giving me a scholarship.
Is this the only day school in Sydney?
So there's three high schools.
Okay, so again, if...
No, but none of them would accept. None of them would give a scholarship, let's just say.
Yeah, it would
could
seem the following.
Could the Beit Din force them to accept a student?
They very well might. The Jewish community has an obligation. This is a very important obligation, to make Jewish education available to every child whose parents or the child is seeking it.
So technically,
this is a religious obligation. Now, this was a big issue, not only for money. I'll tell you where it also became an issue. Many yeshivas in New York, especially, they only want to accept bright, elite students. So if you're this is more for a high school than elementary, if you're just an average kid, you're fine, you're an average kid. You might find it difficult to find the yeshiva that would admit you, because every yeshiva wants to say, we are the yeshiva for the geniuses, we are the yeshiva for the mitsuyanim. So there are middle of the road, or kids who are maybe a little learning disabled, who cannot find the yeshiva. Because yeshivas don't want to, or girls, same thing with girls' schools, they don't want to diminish their reputations. And I remember that some very, very great gedolim basically said that this was a grave sin. It is a grave sin that in the interests of elitism and enhancing your school's reputation, You don't cater to so-called average people. Many great rabbis can come out of, you know, the so-called average, and the like. So these are again, we're a little off topic, but these are major conflicts and problems that we have in the Jewish educational system. It's a problem in Israel too. You know, many Ashkenazic schools will refuse to accept Sfardim. It's a very big problem, because they say Sfardim will dilute the prestige of their institution, because Sfardim are sometimes, wrongfully so, of course, regarded as inferior in different ways. In fact, there's even a shtick now. It's an amazing thing. When you apply to get your kid into these exclusive schools, so you have to write your name. Now, some names are recognizably Sephardic. Azulai, whatever it would be. So a lot of Sephardim are putting down Goldberg, or they're putting down Weinstein. They're putting down Ashkenazic names to get their child accepted. And then, you know, once their child is in, they can't kick the child out. So now, on applications, as the schools became aware of this, they now ask, list all names that you have had for the past 5 years. So that way, if you change, assuming you won't lie, you might lie too, but assuming you won't lie, so if you changed your name last year to get your kid into an Ashkenazic school, you're going to have to say, oh, my original name was Azulay, or whatever it is, and the like. These are real problems that,
yeah, right?
These are problems that come up, huh? Yeah. Okay. Alrighty. How did I get onto this? I have no. Oh yeah. I was just mentioning that a woman in a Beit Din will be able to get private school tuition, which she would not be able to get in a secular court, and the like. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about how marriages.
There is a way in the secular court to get it.
Yeah, my dad.
So if you can prove the education that the child's going to receive at a public school versus a private school is significantly different, they have to force the father to pay for it.
Well, when you say different, do you mean just the general education
is
different?
It's not in the best interest of the child. For example, public schools may have social problems that...
Okay, it might be. But all I'm saying is, if there is a good public school, but it's not a religious school... Technically speaking, a judge will be indifferent, because separation of church and state. A judge is not going to say, oh, you have to give your child a religious... Now, sometimes judges will say, if the kid was used to it... Huh?
If the family is religious, shouldn't then the judge, regardless of being separated from religion as judiciary branch of the state, they should probably say... For the sake of the family is religious, the kid should be sent to a religious school.
Well, it might be, but let's say both parents are split, meaning to say, let's say father is no longer religious.
No, it doesn't matter, but if the kids are staying with their mother, and the mother is a religious, and she wants to have a religious home, then... It may be
an issue, but let's say there's joint custody and the child is going back and forth, so, you know, there's
or
no reason.
The father says, I don't want my kid to be religious,
yeah.
I think Judaism sucks, I don't want them
that's
to
correct,
be
that's
school.
Correct, that's
then
correct, that's correct.
Or
let's say it's joint custody, which, by the way, this is another problem, forget about tuition. There are situations where parents are divorced, people who were, let's say, originally religious. One parent has decided they don't want to be religious anymore. Or, to make it even more extreme, one parent has decided to become religious of another religion. The Jews for Jesus.
Voila.
And there's joint custody. The kid goes back and forth. When the kid is with one parent, there is Shabbos, there is Kashrus. And the kid is with the other parent, Treif.
Christmas.
Christmas? Very, very awful. Very, very painful. Very, very difficult.
Well, they love it.
Well, okay. yeah. And these things happen. And secularly, a judge may not interfere with that. You know, all right, you're this, you're that. Why is one thing better than the other thing? And the like. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about the process of get and the problem that we have with aguna. The word get... is simply an Aramaic word that means legal document. Technically, even a monetary IOU could be called a get, but in more common speech, get is the document that is written for a Jewish halachic divorce. How does that work? A get is a document written on parchment, typically by a sofer, handwritten, like a Torah scroll. It's in the same types of letters as a Torah scroll. And it's 12 lines. It takes a sofer. Each get is tailor-made for the occasion. I mean, you cannot use, unlike a ketubah, that you can actually use a pre-printed ketubah and fill in the names. A get has to be specifically written for the particular divorce. There's no such thing as a, I mean, you can find a form so you'll know what it is, but you cannot use any type of pre-printed get or the like. So typically, it takes a sofer, let's say 45 minutes to write a get. It doesn't take a huge amount of time. Okay, so what happens is, what does the get say? The get basically says, names are a big deal because it has to mention all your names. So let's say the husband's name is Charlie, whose Hebrew name is Yaakov, and his English name is Charles, and his nickname is Chuck. So a get has to have all of the names. So it says, I, Yaakov, and it's written in Hebrew, I, Yaakov, also known as Charles, with the nickname of Chuck and Charlie, son of Moshe, known as Morris, with the nickname of Mickey and Mikey, hereby give this document to my wife, Sarah, who is known as Suri, daughter of... names are... You have to put in all nicknames, all references, etc. Because we have to know for sure that it's written for this couple. Because otherwise, maybe there's another Charlie and another Sarah that are getting divorced. And we have to know it specifically for them. So what happens basically is, a husband and a wife show up in front of a rabbinical court, a Beit Din. And if the husband and the wife don't want to see each other, each of them, or both of them, can do this through a shaliach, through a proxy. Mm. So you may have husband and wife facing each other, or you may have husband shaliach facing the wife, or the husband facing the wife's shaliach, especially if they're in another country, or it may be shaliach facing shaliach. And there's all sorts of rules about how do you appoint shaliach and the like. The sofer, well, the Beit Din will ask everybody to give identification, driver's licenses, to that sahut, social security, whatever identification would be necessary. The sofer then writes the get in their presence. Then the husband is given this piece of parchment. The husband, or the shaliach, hands it physically to the wife, and there's a whole ceremony. She cups her hands like this. The paper is like, the parchment is dropped, and she closes her hands on it, and she walks four amos with the get, and halachically she is now divorced. So a Jewish divorce ceremony, the ceremony itself, can take under an hour. It does not have to take a long time at all. One thing I do want to warn you, well, hopefully you'll never experience it, but one thing you need to know about a Jewish divorce ceremony is that it is conducted in a very business-like fashion. Now, meaning the rabbis on the Beit Din are not there to counsel, they're not there to comfort, they're not there to say, we know how hard this is. They kind of deal with it in a very bureaucratic way. I'm not saying that's good, and I'm not saying that's right. All I'm saying is that if a woman or a man needs a source of support or comfort, they should either bring their dog or bring their friend, as it were. Because the point is, the get is the last nail in the coffin, meaning to say, they will not write a get until you've done counseling, until you've tried to work things out. So by the time you go to the get, it's the last thing, and therefore they don't spend time talking about reconciliation and the like. That would have taken place beforehand. Right? So the whole get ceremony is under an hour. How much does a get cost? Typically, you know, there's a minimal cost that the husband is supposed to pay, but if he doesn't, the wife will pay if she wants the get. It costs under $500. In Israel, it would cost around 1,000 shekel. That's the get proceeding itself. Now, interestingly enough, the woman does not keep her get. The get is then given back to the Beit Din, And what the Beit Din does is it draws an X through the get to be sure that it not be used again. Actually, it's not it's an X with a knife. They actually scratch into the get an X, so it won't be used again. And what the woman is given is, the woman is then given a letter signed by the three rabbis of the Beit Din that a get had been delivered to the woman on such and such a day, and this will be her proof that she's able to marry. And if there's any question, the Beit Din keeps the get in their records, so they could produce the get if that is necessary. So the actual get remains with the Beit Din and the like. Once a woman gets a get, she is now free to remarry anyone except a Kohen. A woman cannot marry, a divorced woman cannot marry a Kohen. But do you know the halacha that a divorced woman or a widow cannot get married for 3 months after the divorce or after the death of her husband? The reason is very interesting. Because in the absence of pregnancy tests, a pregnancy would often not be determined till after the first trimester. So here's the problem. Let's say a woman were to marry after 1 month, and she would give birth 8 months later. There would be uncertainty. Is this a 9-month pregnancy of the late husband or the divorced husband? Or is this an 8-month pregnancy of the new husband? And there would be paternal uncertainty. So because of this, there is a takana of the Chachamim that a divorced or a widowed woman cannot marry till she waits 3 months, and then we see she's not pregnant. Now, there is a whole machlokas today. Can we rely on pregnancy tests and the like? But the custom still is that even with all the tests, we wait 3 months. Right, so that's an important halacha to know. It would be the same type of problem, because obviously whenever the child is born, you could do a DNA test and the like, but still we treat this as a permanent halachic feature. Okay.
I thought that's one that's really argued about that much. I can't imagine someone getting out of a marriage and like wanting to get married the next day.
Well, unless she had an affair. You're correct. And of course, keep in mind, if a woman had an affair, this is another halacha to be aware of, if a woman had an affair during her marriage, she is actually not allowed to marry the guy she had an affair with even after her divorce. That's an issur in the Torah, right? So you're right. As I say, it's not a serious, it's not a serious issue necessarily, but this 3-month rule is a rule that halacha requires. Okay.
Is that enforced? Because I feel like so many women have affairs these days and then get married to those people.
I know
someone who did that.
Well, I mean, nothing is enforced today, because how do we enforce it today? But here's the thing. If a woman goes to a rabbi and says, I want to be married, and the rabbi will see, well, were you married before? And she says, yes, and she'll show me a get, okay? And then she'll ask me to be Masadir Kedushin. If I have a strong suspicion that she had an affair with this person, and I try to verify it, and I'm not satisfied, I as a rabbi, am not allowed to officiate. So I can't stop them from living together. But I, as a rabbi, am not supposed to officiate if I suspect that they had an affair while they were... It's not while he was married as well.
How did you define an affair? Like, she knew the guy on social...
No. I mean very specifically. She had sexual intercourse. Okay. No. That's what I mean. I don't mean...
Maybe she just...
No. I don't mean that she had lunch with him. This refers to only sexual intercourse. Yeah.
What if, like, if a man has an affair?
It doesn't disqualify him.
Oh, no, guys are always
accepted. How does that change things, though? If they were
equality,
both,
right?
If each of them were married. And they have an affair, then...
But if she wasn't married?
No. If a man was married... Okay, let me put this way. If a man was married, and a man had an affair, intercourse, actually, with an unmarried woman, if he divorces his wife, or his wife dies, he is allowed to marry that single woman. But if, on the other hand, a married or single man had an affair with a married woman, and that married woman gets divorced or dies, I'm sorry. The married woman gets divorced or her husband dies, then that man that she had an affair with would not be allowed to marry her. And that is the halacha. But again, when you ask how do we enforce it, the answer, we never enforce it because we don't always know, but the context would be that I as a rabbi would not officiate.
It just sounds like guys have just an easier way out always.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is it all goes back to the idea that male polygamy is permitted. In other words, since a man is permitted to have more than one wife, so you can't call it adultery when he's with another woman, because he's allowed to have two wives. I mean, ultimately that's going to be your issue. Until you answer that, then all these other things follow from that consequence. Okay. Now, the thing about a get is this. In order for a get to be written and delivered, the husband or his agent, and the husband appoints his agent, has to authorize the scribe to write the get. Right? The husband has to tell the scribe, you write this get. And the husband has to deliver the get. In other words, the Beit Din... See, let's consider a secular divorce for a moment. In a secular divorce, who ends the marriage?
Judge.
It is a judge. The judge declares this marriage is over. Under Jewish law, the Beit Din does not end the marriage. The Beit Din is supervising a procedure where the husband or the husband's agent ends the marriage by giving a get. The same, in a way, it's symmetrical to marriage. The same way marriage is husband gives wife a ring, divorce is husband gives wife a get. Okay? It's very, very different than civil divorce. Civil divorce is a judicial action. It is an action of a court. Jewish divorce is an action of the husband. Now, this automatically creates the following dilemma. What if husband doesn't want to give his wife a get? Even if she has an America civil divorce. Now in Israel, you can't even get a civil divorce. But even in America, she gets a civil divorce. She doesn't need the husband's permission for a civil divorce. But the husband says, I don't want to give a get. Now, why would a husband not want to give a get to his wife? So there are a lot of reasons. In a minority of cases... in a minority of cases, and it is a minority of cases, the husband might really want to reconcile. He says, I love you, I want to try to work it out.
Yeah, if he beat you a few times.
That's a minority of cases. Other times, the husband is holding the get back to get better concessions. So the husband will basically say, it's like blackmail. Husband will basically say, give me the kids full time.
What happened to the ketubah?
Okay, so
I thought that's a woman's security of if they get is the divorce process, right?
Yes.
So is it which one has a higher is higher level, higher power?
Okay, so here you have to understand something. The ketubah does not say anything about getting a divorce. The ketubah just says when she is divorced, she's entitled to a certain amount of money. But the ketubah itself, this is a misconception a lot of people have. The ketubah itself does not terminate the marriage. It's only the get that terminates the marriage.
But so the get has their own conditions.
The what?
The get has its conditions.
Well, the get has to be authorized by the husband. The ketubah doesn't do that authorization.
So if it's an abusive relationship with the husband, the woman can't do anything.
No. That's what I want. Again, this is part of a long... Yeah, I'll get to all that. I understand that there's a lot of questions here. I just want to describe the problem generally, and we'll get to... What can a woman do? What does a woman do? That's really our whole subject. We're going to continue it next week as well. I just want to talk about initially, why would a husband not want to give his wife a get if there's a divorce?
He wants money.
So one is shalom bayit, which is the minority. He wants to reconcile. Two is blackmail, in which he is holding out for favorable child custody, or waiver of child support, or waiver of property. In other words, it's blackmail. Or just bribery. He basically says, pay me $100,000 and I'll give you a get. That happens. And the third reason is the most difficult of all, and that is he just wants to cause her suffering. Even if you give him all the money and give him everything, He doesn't care. He wants to hurt her. He wants to ruin her. And even if that ruins him...
So does that, what does the Bethan do then?
I can't answer it immediately. This is a long topic. In fact, maybe I'm a little invested in talking about this because I actually wrote a book on this topic. So that's why I have a lot to say about it.
You're the best person with some questions.
Again, I promise you, if you stay with it, you'll know a lot about this topic and the different rights that women have. Okay. So what do we do? So, yeah.
Kind of real quick. What about if a woman's not she lives in like an orthodox, very orthodox setting, and she's not educated about her rights?
Well,
because it sounds like from us, like what we hear, it's like loopholes in the system.
No. Well, of course. Listen. When a person doesn't know their rights, they're always going to be at a big disadvantage. So obviously, she has to find a way to talk to people who can inform her. Now, let me tell you right at the outset, there are organizations, maybe before we even get into the problem, there are organizations, religious organizations, that are established to help women through the get process when there are difficulties. One very good, although controversial, and I have some disagreements with them, one organization is called ORA. O-R-A. O-R-A stands for it's a pun. ORA means light.
Jeremy,
is
that?
Yes, Rabbi Jeremy Stern. ORA is Organization for the Prevention of Agunot. And they have helped, in like 10 years, they have helped 254 women get divorces from men who were refusing to give them a get, which is a pretty good track record. Some of their methods are controversial. They have demonstrations and Facebook rallies, and there are some issues there. But they've been somewhat effective and the like. So ORA is a good organization to be aware of. There's also an organization, Kayama. So women should be aware of this. In Israel, there's an organization called Mavoi Satum, which is an interesting pun. That means a dead-end alley. It's actually taken from the laws of Erev, but they applied it to the predicament of an aguna, like a dead-end alley and the like. So these are organizations. Now, how will a woman in a Hasidish ultra-Orthodox community be aware of this? I don't know. That's going to be a problem. But there are organizations out there that are designed to help. Now,
if you go to toilets, they're always stickers.
To do what?
Like if you go to the toilet, public toilets, they're always stickers.
Okay. So,
Yeah.
But now, let's just discuss a few things here. What is the halacha if a woman doesn't have a get, but she says, well, okay, I can't get a get, so I'll just get married without a get?
She's not really married.
So, a few things. If a woman tries to get married without a get, her second marriage is not valid, number one. Number two, she is committing adultery, which is a violation of one of the Ten Commandments. Number three, any children born from that adulterous marriage are, God forbid, a mamzer, and a mamzer cannot marry other Jews. A mamzer could marry another mamzeret, or a mamzer could also marry a Jew who converted, but could not marry a Jew that didn't convert.
This happens so often now.
So this is mamzer. Now, let me point out that this problem of marrying without a get is not only an aguna problem about a bad guy who doesn't give his wife a get. This can happen even by accident. You have people who are married and they had a kosher marriage and they didn't even know about a get. It's not that husband was a bad guy. They got a civil divorce. And they thought that was it. And woman got married and had a child and the kid's a mamzer. Now, if nobody's religious, maybe nobody cares. But what happens if that child becomes a Baal Tshuva 25 or 30 years later and then discovers that he was born from a second marriage where the first marriage didn't have a get? Right? Those are going to be potential problems. So the aguna problem is not only bad guys who don't give gets, although that's the main problem. It can apply to even inadvertent situations. Okay? Now, again, there's a lot of background in all of this and the like. Now, let me ask you the reverse question. What are the consequences of a man who is married to a woman who wants to remarry without a get? Marry somebody else without a get. Right? If a woman marries without a get, right, it's adultery and the children are mamzer. What if a man? So here you have to understand the following. You have to understand the following. Since the Torah permits a man, to have more than one wife, then strictly speaking, if a man marries a woman without giving his first wife a get, the worst he's guilty of is polygamy. But polygamy, as far as the Torah is concerned, is permitted for a man. Now, so why don't all of us have more than one wife? The answer is, for Ashkenazic Jews, polygamy is prohibited, rabbinically, and this dates from the 11th century. In the 11th century, there was a great, great rabbi. He was the teacher of the teacher of Rashi. This is before Rashi. And his name was Rabbeinu, Rabbeinu was his title, Rabbeinu Gershom. And he was the undisputed leader of Ashkenazic Jewry in a way that we really have not had since. And he and his Beis Din made a number of takanos that were accepted by Ashkenazic Jews. And among those takanos were that men cannot marry more than one wife. So since the 11th century, the 1000s, polygamy has been prohibited, male polygamy has been prohibited among Ashkenazic Jews. Now, there was an interesting loophole. Originally, his ban was supposed to expire in the year 5000, which would have been a long time ago, but it got renewed. Well, because there was why would it expire, you mean?
Or like when the Messiah comes, are men allowed to continue with polygamy?
Well, no, it got renewed forever, so, you know, the Messiah's not going to change that.
No, but, like, why did he say a certain year?
The concept was there was a feeling that since he was promulgating an edict that is not in the Talmud, he thought he didn't have the authority to make it forever. Only Talmudic laws can be forever, so he thought there had to be a time, an expiration of time. Now, why do I say only Ashkenazim? Ashkenazic Jews, as you know, are the Jews from Germany, France, England, Poland, Lithuania, Russia. The Sephardic Jews are from Spain, North Africa, Morocco, etc., and the Middle East. Now, the Sephardic Jews were not subject to Rabbeinu Gershom's authority. He was the leader of the Ashkenazic Jews. So Sephardic Jews continued to practice polygamy. In fact, it's actually very interesting historically, because Ashkenazic Jews lived in Christian countries where Christians did not practice polygamy. Sephardic Jews lived in Islamic countries where Muslims did practice polygamy. So in some ways, I'm not saying they're connected, but in some ways it's very, very interesting that the halachic rules were mirroring what was the general culture rule as well. So Sephardim technically were allowed, and actually are allowed, to have polygamy, more than one wife. Now, in Israel, there was an interesting development. Israel, as you know, has two chief rabbis. There's an Ashkenazic chief rabbi and a Sephardic chief rabbi. Like, you know, Israel has always had two chief rabbis. In 1948, when the State of Israel was established, the two chief rabbis at the time, who were they? The first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the State of Israel was Rav Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, Rav Herzog. Rav Cook was the first chief rabbi, but that was before the state. Rav Cook was officially called the chief rabbi of Palestine. He died in the 1930s before there was a state of Israel. But the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi was Rav Yitzchak Herzog, whose son later became president of the State of Israel, Chaim Herzog. Unfortunately, not the religious man himself, but Rav Herzog was a great, great Talmud Chacham. And the Sephardic chief rabbi was Rav Meir Ben Uziel, Rav Uziel. And together they made a joint agreement that they wanted to have uniformity in certain behaviors. So they agreed that Sephardim would not practice polygamy anymore. So as a result, in the State of Israel, it is now part of the Rabbanut's rules that Sephardim do not practice polygamy, but they had a grandfather clause, quite literally, and that is, any person who came to Israel with more than, any Sephardic person who came to Israel with more than one wife would be permitted to remain married to multiple wives. So in the early 1950s, there were Yemenites, Taimanim, who came to Eretz Yisrael, and some of them did have more than one wife, and they were permitted to remain with more than one wife. And now, are there any alive today? I really don't know. I'm wondering if there's any like old folks that are still around with more than one wife. I just want to say, compare this to the United States and the Mormons. You know, the Mormons used to practice polygamy. And for some reason, this got the United States like fanatic. The United States went in with guns and waged war against them and like massacred. I mean, it's an amazing thing to me. Why is polygamy so worse than adultery? Adultery, Rechamah, people do indiscriminately. And that's fine. But you try polygamy, the federal government will come after you with literally machine guns. I don't know why polygamy is like such a worse... Yeah, but it's worse than adultery. I mean, polygamy, the federal government will, you know, mamish, kill you. This is what they did if you read about the Mormons, they killed many, many Mormons over the polygamy issue and the like. Okay. Be this it may, a woman who marries without a get, again, this is all introductory because I know there's so many questions and I promise you these questions will be addressed. But a woman who commits, who marries without a get, is committing adultery, and the kids are mamzerim. A man who marries without a get is not committing adultery. His kids are not mamzer, but he is in violation of the ban, at least if he's Ashkenazi, he's in violation of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. So, the man is committing a sin, but the sin that he's committing is not of the same magnitude as the sin that the woman is committing. Now, another thing. The ban of Rabbeinu Gershom has a way out, which a woman doesn't have. Again, I realize how this sounds. And that is, since under Torah law, male polygamy is permitted. It's only the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. There is a proviso in the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom that if the man is willing to divorce his wife, but she's unwilling to accept the get, if he deposits the get in escrow with a Beit Din that she could pick it up, and he then gets a dispensation from 100 rabbis in at least 3 countries who will give him permission, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom will be lifted and he will be permitted to marry without divorcing his first wife, provided he's deposited a get to be picked up by her. This is a very controversial procedure.
100 rabbis.
This is called 100 rabbis. It's called Heter, the dispensation of Maya Rabbanim, of 100.
Has this ever happened?
Oh, it does. Absolutely, it happens. It absolutely happens.
A man who did it, and his wife wanted to get, but he wouldn't give it to her.
Yes. Now that's pure evil. Yes. And I'm not going to hold back my criticism of that. There are situations.
So why would 100 rabbis agree to that?
The answer is, there is corrupt. There is, again, I'm not going to say. I mean, most rabbis are honest and devoted and faithful. I'm not going to impugn rabbis, my club, so to speak. But there are components within the community that are bad apples, that are Rishayim, that allow and facilitate abuses of the system. And sometimes they'll give the guy his cake and eat it too, meaning to say, they'll, you know, believe him that I want to divorce my wife, even though he's refusing to give a get. He'll get a heter mei rabbanim, he gets to marry, and she doesn't have a get.
Wait, how do they believe that?
Do they not talk to the wife first?
Obviously they don't.
It's hard to know. They talk to the wife, well, they don't talk to the wife.
Out of 100 rabbis, one
often enough, it's not an uncommon thing. That would be the typical...
No, the typical situation is the male agud, meaning to say like this. When it works right, the man says, you know, I am willing, ready, and able to divorce my wife and give her a get. She's refusing to accept it.
Mm.
So in such a case, the Beis Din will say, you write a get, you deposit it in a Beit Din. Your wife will be notified that any time she wants to get the get, she can show up and get it, or send your shaliach. And then 100 rabbis will allow you to marry. That's the proper use of it.
Right.
Now, to use a heter mei rabbanim when he refuses to give a get is totally evil. It's a total evil. It's not even a valid act, first of all. It's not a valid heter mei rabbanim.
Because you have to deposit it.
Absolutely. You have to deposit it. You cannot get a heter mei rabbanim to allow the man to marry unless he has done whatever he can to allow the woman to marry. But the point I'm making is, though, that even when the heter mei rabbanim functions well, it helps the man who wants to give a get, but it doesn't help the woman who needs the get and the man doesn't give it. There is no heter mei rabbanim for the woman. Now, the reason that's so, I mean, it's logical, although it's a hard result, because for the woman, you're dealing with a Torah violation of adultery. Heter mei rabbanim cannot take away a Torah law, but the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom can be modified by a built-in heter mei rabbanim. Now, I do know there are some rabbis who, as a matter of principle, will never sign a heter mei rabbanim because they feel, because of the occasional abuses, they literally refuse to have anything to do with this procedure. So it is a halachic procedure, but they will not. They, you know, if they get the documents and everything else, they will say, I'm not gonna get involved with this whatsoever. Okay? So this is why, theoretically, therefore, can a man be an agud? Yes, he can. Right? So a woman is called aguna, right? If the man doesn't give her a get, and if a woman refuses to receive it, he's called an agun. But the problem of the agun is not as bad as the problem of the aguna. The agun has heter mei rabbanim and doesn't have a problem of mamzer. The aguna does have a problem of mamzer and does not have the release of the heter mei rabbanim. Okay. Now, let me just give me another minute, and then again, we'll obviously have, this is just the very, very beginning of this topic. Let me point out, in a pure halachic system, which Israel is not, and certainly America is not, the problem of an aguna would be much less pronounced than it is today. Because in the time of the Gemara, a Beit Din could order a man to give a get. And if a man refused to give a get, now they couldn't divorce the woman on their own, but they could beat the man until he agrees to give the get.
That sounds good.
Yeah, and if he keeps on saying no, you keep on beating him
until he dies.
In which case,
and then she's a widow.
Yeah, it's even better for the woman. She could marry a Kohen.
So
that's correct. Meaning the Beit Din can actually beat the person until he agrees.
She can marry a Kohen,
and if that kills him in the process.
Yeah.
So be it. That's his fault. He could have said
we
at any point.
Right.
So in a pure halachic system, there was an element of actual coercion that could be implied. In fact, they tell the story, at least this is called causing upon divine forces, of the great Rabbi Akiva Eiger, one of the great, great Gedolim 200 years ago, that he once called in a recalcitrant husband who refused to give his wife a get, and said, did you ever learn Mishnah? He said, yeah. So he took out the first Mishnah in Tractate Kedushin that says a woman can be freed of a marriage by a get or by the death of her husband. Rebbe Kiveger says, I'm giving you your choice. Which way do you want to go? Get or death? So the man was very offended by this. So he stormed out of the room. He tripped on a rock and he smashed his head and died.
I was like, well, I guess he chose death.
So, so he was given warning. He didn't listen to it. And that happened. So the point basically is, if indeed we have this aguna problem, part of it is the lack of power of a Beit Din to enforce compliance. Meaning when Mashiach comes, okay, first of all, when Mashiach comes, there will not be this problem because people will be living on a more higher level. But even if, God forbid, there would be some bad people when Mashiach comes, the Beit Din would be able to enforce it. Yeah.
So I was always wondering if there's a halakhic issue with this. In modern times, the Beit Din, they can tell like all the like businesses in the town, like, don't serve this guy.
Yes. So that's a very important point. The very important point is that although Beit Dins today do not have the power to beat people to their death, there are lesser things they can do. They could encourage or even order community boycotts. They could excommunicate people. They could basically say that nobody should do business with them. They could say that this man shall not be admitted into any synagogue, even for his own children's bar mitzvah.
Couldn't they do the same thing for the woman?
Yes, they could. They could go to either side. Yeah, absolutely. But I'll tell you why there's a problem with that. The reason why there's a problem with that is, I mean, absolutely, that's totally proper. And it's done. But the problem today is that because there is no centralized basin, number one, there are just a lot of different basins, and number two, because so many Jews aren't even religious. So let's say a Beit Din has issued a rule that nobody should speak to this man, nobody shall, count the man for a minion. Okay, if he's not religious, he doesn't care. He'll go somewhere else. And number two, there's so much fragmentation that he'll just go to another shul. And unfortunately, not every shul will obey every decision of every other Beit Din. You walk by Jerusalem, I don't know if you study the wall posters, they're called Pashkevilin. You know, all those posters all the time. I don't know if you look at it, a lot of them are funeral notices and like, but if you ever look at them, you'll notice quite a few people are put into excommunication. And nobody even reads them. This person is hereby excommunicated. Nobody pays attention. I'll go to the shul down the street. So what you're saying is theoretically very powerful. Now, if, for example, the person, let's say, is a Chabad Chassid, right, so being part of Chabad is very important to him. And then Chabad would put him in Cherem, so that would be a big, big deal. But, you know, if he moves around from one place to the other place, you know, Chabad's Cherem is not necessarily going to be accepted by Satmir or somebody else, so he'll become a Satmir Chassid or do something else. So that's a real issue. The decentralization of authority. You know, I just read, you've heard of the famous Dutch philosopher, he was a Jew, but he died a Christian, unfortunately, Benedict Spinoza. Spinoza was one of the great, from a secular standpoint, he's considered to be one of the greatest philosophers, but he was a real heretic. He was an Apicurus. He was the first philosopher who really taught that the Torah is not from God. I mean, he really was an Apicurus. He was from Amsterdam, and he was only 23 years old, and he was excommunicated by the Amsterdam Jewish community. And I saw the document. This was frightening. They said, cursed by day and cursed by night. Awful, awful curses. And this made him an outcast. In those days, it was a unified community. He was literally an outcast. Nobody spoke to him. Nobody, you know, it's as if you were within his four amos, you would have to suffer. That was a powerful thing. But, you know, the Chayrim today, people just, unfortunately, people just ignore. So it doesn't have that same effectiveness unless you're part of a Hasidic community that's your community and that's going to, you know, hurt you and the like. Okay. So we'll continue this next week. You all have a good week and thank you for taking care of that. I appreciate it.
Okay. No problem.
All right.